Hello, I'm Hugh Bennett for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The cover story this week, Drowning in Bonds, How the Bond Market is Playing Havoc on Margins at North Carolina Community Banks. This week's cover story is written by Lauren Onosorge, and it's entitled Bear Bonds, B-E-A-R. It was 2020. COVID had struck, and with it, the federal government swooped in, funneling hundreds of millions into North Carolina businesses in the form of Paycheck Protection Program capital. Local banks facilitated the PPP loan program, and in turn, many of those dollars were returned as deposits. Banks such as Uari Capital and Albemarle were suddenly flush with dollars. As a bank, you can't afford to sit there with $400 million in cash, earning basically 0%. So you've got to do something with that, and the loan demand was not there, Chief Financial Officer Heather Allman says. So Uari did what many banks did. It turned to the bond market. As of the second quarter, Uari was among five North Carolina community banks with more than 30% of its assets and securities available for sale. But there's a problem. In 2022, the bond market suffered its worst year on record as the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates aggressively to fight high inflation. The 35.1% of Uari's available for sale bond portfolio has lost 11% of its value, and Uari is not alone. An analysis of North Carolina Community Bank data from Raymond James shows that every single one saw losses in their bond portfolios. Add in margin compression, which North State Bank CEO Larry Barber calls the highest in my career, and it's a situation that might from the outside seem untenable. But bankers say they're pushing through the headwinds that seem to keep coming. Underwater but not out. The bond issue is familiar to those watching what happened in Silicon Valley Bank. Portfolios are only underwater on paper. As long as the bank isn't forced to sell those bonds, that's where they'll stay, on paper and under less regulatory scrutiny. But SVP needed liquidity as its tech customers were hit hard. So when the value of its bond portfolio dipped, it sought outside capital to make up the difference. But the bankers just weren't there, leading anxious customers to pull out their money, creating a bank run and a subsequent bank failure. Bankers have called it a crisis of confidence that's contained with SVP, but the bond issue is clearly widespread. The Federal Reserve Board announced in March that it would make available additional funding to assure banks could meet the needs of their depositors without liquidating those portfolios, but Fed representatives haven't released a list of institutions that have taken them up on the offer. Locally, bankers have said they wouldn't be afraid to use the bank term funding program if necessary, but they say market demographics in the Triangle likely will keep them afloat as the markets recover. For example, Roxborough Savings Bank has 45.5% of its assets in available-for-sale bonds. CEO Keith Epstein says the bank has the capital to absorb the losses at 10%, according to Raymond James, but that certainly wouldn't be ideal. We have to maintain deposits so we have funds for loans and operations without having to sell the bonds, says Epstein, adding that if bond rates improved, bond pricing could follow suit. If rates stay where they are now, then we just have to be patient. Add in the rising cost of deposits, continued fallout from the March failure of a trio of banks, and it adds up to a dicey proposition, one that signals profitability problems, says Brian Liebfried, Managing Director of Client Insights and Analytics at Performance Trust. He predicts that if interest rates stay the same, there will be more than 1,000 unprofitable banks in a year. At the largest community bank in the region, First Bank, more than 22% of its assets are in available-for-sale securities. It's a portfolio that has lost 16.8% of its value. Triangle Market President Travis Bailey says the focus would be on holding securities to maturity. He says the differentiator for banks such as his is being local. First Bank, unlike some of its peers, relies heavily on its branches. In some parts of the state, it's the only branch in a community, he says. Numbers from Raymond James show the average community bank in North Carolina has lost 11% of its bond portfolio value. But bond portfolios are just part of the challenge. Enter in margins, which Barber, CEO of Raleigh's North State Bank, calls the worst in his career amid the rising cost of deposits. Banks working to keep customers still wary from the SVB bank run have upped their interest rates to their own detriment. Raymond James' data on community bank deposits show that in North Carolina, median deposit coffers were flat quarter to quarter in the first 6 months of 2023, but a look into the nuances of those numbers shows those deposits are costing banks more, and that could contribute to higher loan rates as banks work to make up the difference on their balance sheets. Liebridge says deposit costs will keep rising if the Fed does not cut rates. Of the top 20 community banks in the state, all but five saw their non-interest-bearing deposits, transactional products such as payroll accounts and checking, shrink in the first 6 months of 2023, according to an analysis of numbers compiled by Raymond James. Instead, banks are shifting money into higher return vehicles such as money markets and CDs, which spikes the cost for banks. Looking statewide at 40 banks analyzed by Raymond James, the cost of deposits rose a median of 42.6% quarter to quarter. Money markets alone rose by a median of 179% across all community banks in the state. And with them came the margins, creating a tough situation for banks big and small. As First Bank's Bailey notes, it is costing us a lot more money to be able to do business today than it was just this time last year. In terms of numbers, average margins increased from the end of 2021 to second quarter 2023. Banks whose books show more reliance on broker deposits saw big dips, such as Live Oak, which saw its margins drop 70 basis points in six quarters, and First Carolina, which dove 69 basis points. But for the most part, margins were rising until 2023 hit. In the last 6 months, margins at most of the banks that were part of the Raymond James analysis dropped, with a few exceptions, such as M&F Bank and North State. But even those banks are feeling the pressure. Jim Sills, CEO of M&F Bank in Durham, says depositors moving to higher-yield products also makes banks pickier when it comes to lending. We have to make sure it's excellent credit, he says. We have to make sure we're dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's relative to that loan request. That's another concern for industry watchers. Loans tightening and making capital for key projects in the Triangle and elsewhere more expensive. Some banks have another factor being scrutinized by industry watchers, and that's a reliance on brokered deposits, a fast way to shore up a balance sheet. Instead of relying on local customer base, some banks are teaming up with third-party brokers such as Morgan Stanley, but it typically comes at a higher cost, further putting pressure on margins. U.S. banks combined held more than $1.2 trillion in brokered deposits in the second quarter, according to the Wall Street Journal. That's an 86% increase from the year prior. And local banks, too, are taking advantage of brokered deposits as a quick and easy way to raise capital. At First Carolina, for example, 42% of its deposits are brokered. Regulators have been scrutinizing the practice, worried that lenders could take excessive risks to make up for the expense of the funding. The FDIC, in a 2011 report to Congress, tied reliance on brokered deposits to higher probabilities that a bank will fail. But Ron Day, CEO of First Carolina, says the risk isn't in having brokered deposits, but in how the bank chooses to deploy those deposits. He cites his bank's branch light strategy, with just 9 branches across 4 states. We have been a completely organic growth story and have augmented that growth with effective usage of brokered and other more wholesale funding sources with the complete understanding and support of our regulators, he says, adding that by partnering with fintechs, he can create more funding to meet the lending demand in First Carolina's markets. Chris Maranak, research director at Janney Montgomery Scott, agrees that broker deposits aren't necessarily a bad thing and can be managed by institutions that go that route. Brokered funds are like eating dessert. You have to have that, but in doses, Maranak says, you can't have an entire plate full of them. Some worry that finding a balance may be even tougher for banks should rates stay high for a long time. In that case, the margin pressure is likely to continue, forcing some banks to seek outside capital or even buyout deals. You've got all these fixed-rate loans on your books, and they're paying you 3, 4%. You're paying 5% on deposits, and you're losing money, says Bill Wagner, managing director of Raymond James's Raleigh office. The fear is that's what will happen, a scenario where the Fed, in search of its, quote, soft landing, keeps rates high. The Fed has implemented 11 rate increases since March 2022, bringing its benchmark interest rate to the highest level in 22 years. On October 19th, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell signaled that the central bank would likely hold rates steady at its next policy meeting and that still high inflation could make more interest rate increases possible. Additional evidence of persistently above-trend growth could put further progress on inflation at risk and could warrant further tightening of monetary policy, Powell said in front of the Economic Club of New York on October 19th. And statements like that have bankers worried with good reason, Raymond James's Wagner says. If you have got to sit in this situation for another year, that's really going to dig into these banks' profitability, he says. Not all firms are feeling the same squeeze. Fuquay Varina-based Fidelity, for example, is better positioned than most, even with its bond portfolio, and that's because its balance sheet is dominated by non-interest-bearing deposit accounts such as checking. Fidelity doesn't have to make new loans to offset the pressures of rising rates, so even though 37.5% of its assets are in available-for-sale securities, it has other tools to help it weather the environment. However, banks relying on broker deposits will need to find new loans and offset the more expensive capital, and with rates high, customers may be less likely to take on debt. And with securities portfolios underwater, selling bonds is not an attractive option. You run out of funding in a bank, that's when you get yourself in trouble, Wagner says. North State is another bank seemingly better positioned than its peers without the kind of bond pressure that exists at some other institutions. North State's bonds are under by about 9%, but they amount to just 0.5% of its portfolio. CEO Barber says the bank didn't push heavily into bonds because of its mission statement of keeping the dollars local. Nor did he push into broker deposits, but he says there's pressure in the industry to do just that. If you have customers who need your liquidity, the source of liquidity is going to change for some community banks. There's no question about it. You'll see more banks using broker deposits, he says. North State didn't chase the bond market either, having never allowed that temptation into our thinking. The first thing I look at and the last thing I look at is liquidity, Barber says, and liquidity is the linchpin of all banking. Let's turn now to the biz section. The biz section is compiled and written by Dane Huffman. The main article here, Franklin Street on the rebound. Chapel Hill's Franklin Street, which suffered in the pandemic as foot traffic disappeared and iconic businesses like Ye Olde Waffle Shop closed, is showing a renewed sense of life. When Lula's closed in July 2020, three of the storefronts at the corner of Franklin and Columbia Streets were empty. Other setbacks included a devastating fire at the Mediterranean Deli in July, the death in a car accident of two owners of Classic Carolina in September, and Linda's Bar and Grill turning to GoFundMe.com for help with pandemic-related loans. But new energy is coming. University of North Carolina students are eager for Raising Cane's, finally opening at the corner of Franklin and Columbia Streets on November 7th. Raising Cane's paid $3.87 million for the building in December 2021. Raising Cane's being on the corner is a great thing, says Rebecca Mormino, the executive director of the Downtown Chapel Hill Partnership. I know it's a chain, but they put a lot of money into that building and made it look really nice. We hope it stays a long time. The optics of those anchor corners make a difference. The junction, the home for Innovate Carolina, is now open on Franklin Street, and the adjoining property behind it on East Rosemary Street that Grub Properties of Charlotte redeveloped. Meanwhile, a new parking deck is rising on East Rosemary Street, and other developments include Longfellow Real Estate Partners' plans for lab and office space on West Franklin Street. Mormino says foot traffic is almost back to where it used to be. There's a lot going on to be excited about. You can really feel that, she says. I can feel the difference in the air. In Wilmington, a big change for the film scene. The largest film production facility in the state has a new owner. EUE/ScreenGems sold its 50-acre site in Wilmington, which houses 10 sound stages, to CineSpace Studios, which also has facilities in Chicago, Atlanta, Toronto, and Germany. The new leadership will bring industry expertise and commitment to the local community to set the stage for a successful future, says Chris Cooney, owner of EUE ScreenGems. Wilmington's film production has bounced back after the disruption caused by the pandemic. For this global company to look at Wilmington and to think, okay, this is a place where we want to establish a presence, and this is where we want to be able to do business, I think speaks volumes, Johnny Griffin, director of the Wilmington Regional Film Commission, told the Wilmington Business Journal. North Carolina cuts back. State employees and retirees will have at least temporarily restricted access to wildly popular weight loss drugs next year. In October, the State Health Plan Board of Trustees considered cutting coverage to weight loss drugs such as Wegovy and Saxenda, produced by Novo Nordisk. This was a recommendation pushed by State Treasurer Dale Folwell, who says the expensive drugs are putting financial pressure on the state health plan. More than 23,000 members are using the drugs, up from about 2,800 members in mid-2021. The cost has increased over the past 3 years from about $3 million per month to more than $14 million per month before any sort of rebates. The board put a temporary moratorium in place beginning January 1st that would prevent new users from being covered for the drugs. The board will meet again next year to consider additional options for reducing spending on the drugs. 321 Coffee strikes a deal with Weaver Street Market. A local coffee brand known for its community involvement is expanding. 321 Coffee is now selling bags of its coffee in Weaver Street Market stores. The Raleigh brand has grown from a single coffee shop stall in the State Farmers Market to several retail locations and a roasting facility. Two NC State University students founded the company, which employs individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and now has shops in downtown Raleigh, downtown Durham, two corporate headquarters, and a location planned for Centennial Campus. We believe in the power of representation. I want people with disabilities to be able to walk the aisles of grocery stores and see a product that represents them. Now that's happening, says Lindsay Regge, or Regge, W-R-E-G-E, co-founder and CEO of 321 Coffee. This is more than just about coffee. It's a big step toward creating a more inclusive future. Weaver Street Market began with a store on Weaver Street in Carrboro and now has four locations in the Triangle. The Aviation and Finance page is written by Lauren Onasorge. Lufthansa sees possibilities at RDU. The German airline enters Triangle Market in 2024 with high hopes. At Raleigh-Durham International Airport, expectations are high for Lufthansa, the German airline set to launch a nonstop flight to Frankfurt next summer. But behind the buzz, a scramble is underway to ensure the flight's success. Ask Dirk Jansen, vice president of the Americas for Lufthansa, and he says he's confident the flight will pay off. Jansen says RDU has been on Lufthansa's radar since as far back as 2014. While all discussions halted during the pandemic, they restarted in September 2022. The state's financial support clinched the decision. It's customary in the industry that when you evaluate routes, the state, the communities, they make a support package, he says. This is standard in the industry for every airline, and that, of course, helps in making the final decision when you compare the economics of a potential route. Frankfurt is a launching point to global destinations, including places popular for RDU travelers, such as India. We're relying on our partners and the whole community to make sure everyone is aware of these possibilities, Jansen says. Between now and June, the airline is working to secure commitments from area businesses, he says. From Atlanta to Nashville, the richest routes at RDU. Amid a post-pandemic surge in traffic, airlines have pocketed hundreds of millions in revenue from flights serving Raleigh-Durham International Airport in recent months. At the top of the richest routes list, Atlanta. That's according to new numbers released by aviation research firm OAG. For the 12-month period from September 2022 through August of this year, the RDU Atlanta route inked more than $314.3 million in revenue, according to OAG, surpassing other routes such as Denver and Charlotte. Three airlines currently serve RDU: Atlanta, Delta, Frontier, and Southwest. airline cuts flights from RDU to Bahamas. One of Raleigh-Durham International Airport's newest airlines recently paused activity at the airport, citing poor load factors. Bahamas Air, which launched nonstop flights from RDU to Freeport in the Bahamas in November 2022, flew its last triangle passenger in August. Bahamas Air says it plans to resume RDU service November 12th. Initially, Bahamas Air had intended the flight to be year-round, but that changed when load factors dropped during the summer months below 20%, a spokeswoman says. So now Bahamas Air plans to make the flight seasonal with the peak time during the winter holiday season, the spokeswoman says. The retail and restaurant section is compiled and written by Laura Brummett. The top article there, Wake Forest Project Eyes More Expansion. Three more buildings are planned for an area of Wake Forest that is already heavy with retail after a local developer filed site plans with the town to add a second phase to the Wheatfield Shopping Center, which could add around 10 more tenants. The first phase features four buildings with tenants, including Blackbird Brewery and Cape Fear Seafood Company. The 49,000-square-foot center is fully leased, developer Omar L. Casey says. Plans for the second phase call for three buildings totaling around 25,000 square feet. The new phase will be located at the intersection of Rogers Branch Road and Forestville Road, just north of the first phase. The area is a growing spot for retail with a Publix-anchored shopping center and a Harris Teeter-anchored shopping center close by. Al Casey is seeing high interest in his planned center, though no tenant announcements are ready to be made. For both phases, he has seen interest from more tenants than he has room for, Al Casey says. That stems from the area's residential density and strong average income, he says. The shopping center has 27,334 households within a five-mile radius, with an average household income of $86,106. Retail spaces in the new phase can be divided into any size a tenant needs, with lease rates ranging from $37 per square foot per year to $42, according to an online listing. Tenants in the new phase will likely include a medical services company, a breakfast spot, restaurants, and retail services businesses. L. Casey is trying to stay away from leasing to mattress outlets, tobacco shops, and cell phone stores. The site is vacant land measuring 2.3 acres. L. Casey purchased the land in October 2022 for $2.28 million, operating as Sasum LLC. The first phase of Wheatfield is fully leased with several tenants already open. National franchise Chicken Cone was originally stated to open in the center, but the franchisee pulled out due to high construction costs. That space is now being leased by Blackbird Brewery as an extension to their tap room. At Five Points, a new boutique is to focus on children. A high-end children's boutique is opening in Raleigh with Dahl House coming to Five Points. That's D-A-L House. The shop is opening at 2003 Fairview Road in the former Jen's Dry Cleaners and Tailor space. The grand opening is set for November 18th. The store is owned by Caitlin Scott, a North Carolina native. Scott worked for the Runway Collection side for Michael Kors in New York City early in her career. Dahl House will sell high-end clothing, shoes, and accessories from Europe for children ages newborn to 10. Clothing items will range from $50 to $150, Scott says. A familiar names open bar in Glenwood South. A new bar is open in Glenwood South. The bar, called Devolve, is located at 304 Glenwood Avenue in the former space of Devolve Moto, a retail store and coffee bar that had a motorcycle theme. The new bar comes from some of Glenwood South's main ownership groups, a team consisting of Charles Long, Dan Lovenheim, and Matt Kenner. Long, CEO of Centerline Digital, owns the property along with others in Glenwood South. Lovenheim, CEO of Oak City Group, and Kenner, owner of Kenner Group, own some of the street's most popular bars, including The Avenue, Whiskey Rose, Cornerstone Tavern, Alchemy, The Milk Bar, and Pine State Public House. Devolve's interior space spans around 3,700 square feet. It also features a connected outdoor patio at 306 Glenwood Avenue. That's the former Vickers and Ruth Plumbing Company that measures around 3,600 square feet. The On Healthcare and Higher Ed section of the Triangle Business Journal is written and compiled by Zach Ezone. Pfizer cuts to include Durham and Morrisville. Global Pharma cuts costs to close two facilities in Triangle. Pfizer is shrinking its presence in North Carolina as part of a multi-billion-dollar cost-cutting effort. The global pharmaceutical company will shut down operations at sites in Mooresville and Durham. Pfizer confirmed the decision October 27th in an email and said the closures are part of a broader effort to operate more efficiently and effectively. As part of this effort, Pfizer has decided to close the Kitt Creek facility in Mooresville and the Durham Clinical Manufacturing Facility, the company said. Pfizer continues to operate its largest North Carolina facilities, including two in Sanford and one in Rocky Mount. Pfizer did not provide details on the number of workers affected by the closures of the facilities located at 7030 Kitt Creek Road in Mooresville and 1219 Shiloh Glen Drive in Durham. Pfizer said that employees whose jobs are eliminated will receive separation packages and will have the opportunity to apply for other roles within the organization. The closure of the Durham site, which is around 85,000 square feet, comes just a few years after Pfizer opened the gene therapy manufacturing facility as part of a $68.5 million investment. Pfizer acquired the property in 2019 for about $10.3 million from Scannell Properties of Indianapolis, according to Durham County property records. When Pfizer opened the Durham facility in late 2021, it said the site would create more than 50 new jobs. The company also planned to move about 40 employees from a site in Chapel Hill, many of whom joined Pfizer after its acquisition of Bamboo Therapeutics in 2016 to the Durham site. Pfizer earlier this year said it was looking to offload the Durham facility as part of a broader shift in its research and development strategy. The company in January said it was exploring externalization opportunities for a number of highly innovative niche programs in areas such as neurology, cardiology, and gene therapy programs not yet in clinical trials. The Mooresville facility is 40,000 square feet and is owned by Alexandria Real Estate Equities, according to Wake County property records, as part of the Alexandria Innovation Center. RTP firm makes a $91 million deal to buy a bioengineering company. United Therapeutics has reached a deal to buy life sciences company Miromatrix Medical, Inc. for about $91 million. Miromatrix is based in Minnesota and develops bioengineered organs for human transplant from pig livers and kidneys. United, which has headquarters in Research Triangle Park and Maryland, says the purchase will expand its existing organ manufacturing programs. United is acquiring Miromatrix for $3.25 per share in cash, while an additional $1.75 per share in cash will be paid if the company's manufactured kidney product, known as MiroKidney, completes clinical development by the end of 2025. The purchase price represents a premium of roughly 170% on Miromatrix's share price from October 27th, the last trading day prior to the sales announcement. Miromatrix's board has recommended company shareholders approve the deal. And finally, on health and care and higher ed, Wake Med to manage Wake Brook. Wake County has struck a partnership with Wake Med Health that will see the health system manage part of a behavioral health facility in Raleigh. Wake Med manage operations for a 28-bed inpatient psychiatric unit at Wake Brook Behavioral Health Facility. Services at Wake Brook have been on pause since September 30th when the county's previous contract with UNC Health expired. A timeline for when the inpatient psychiatric unit will reopen has not been established. Wake Med is working with the county and Alliance Health to make those important services available as quickly as reasonably possible, the county said in a statement. Kaylee Thompson writes the On Real Estate section. Developer eyes Holly Springs for 600 homes. The project would also include office, retail, in addition to residences. A large mixed-use community with residences, retail, office, and outdoor spaces could be coming to fast-growing Holly Springs. Trinzic Residential Group has filed a rezoning application for 61 acres to allow for a mixed-use development south of the Shops at Holly Springs Retail Center along Highway 55. The proposed zoning is regional mixed use. The current zoning is community business. The new zoning would allow for Aura Wildwood, which would have apartments, townhomes, restaurants, stores, offices, and health and fitness space. If the rezoning is approved, the developments will be allowed up to 400 multifamily units, 200 townhomes, at least 100,000 square feet of commercial space, and about 184,000 square feet of activated open space. Development Director Justin Brown says the company is hoping to break ground in 2025 with a multi-phase timeline of about 3 years. There's no estimated cost yet, and the company is still working on securing funding. The development would be sanctioned into what the company is calling pods, sections of land designated for specific uses. Pod A will have apartments and five-story buildings offering 1, 2, and 3-bedroom units. The buildings will have elevators, and unit square footage would range from 800 to 1,500 square feet. There will be about 30,000 square feet of amenity space for the multifamily buildings, including a swimming pool, clubhouse, and fitness center. Pod B will have for sale townhomes, which will be 3 stories and solar and EV ready. There will be 100,000 square feet of open gathering space with a connection to the Greenway trails. Brown says the company hasn't worked up an estimate for rental rates or listing prices for the residences. Pod C will start the commercial portion of the development, containing a health, fitness, and wellness resort with Lifetime Fitness as the anchor and 50,000 square feet of amenities like a swimming pool, restaurant, bar, and tennis and pickleball courts. Pod D will be the dining and shopping area with restaurants and stores flanking a 2,000 square foot green space. The green space will have outdoor dining and gathering areas. The final pod will be for office and retail. It will transition to an adjacent Lowe's Home Improvement store near the corner of Highway 55 and Ralph Stevens Road and have the second anchor tenant. In Wendell, build-to-rent community coming. A $50 million build-to-rent community is coming to Wendell. Barings, a global investment manager in Charlotte, and developer Folger Pratt of Washington, D.C., acquired a planned 172-home community for $5.8 million, according to Wake County deed records. The companies bought the future Eagle Rise subdivision near Wendell Country Club from Mungo Homes, a division of Clayton Properties Group. The rental community will have 89 townhomes and 83 single-family homes. Mungo Homes will stay on as the home builder. Construction of the homes will start before the end of 2023, with the first homes delivered in second quarter 2024. And finally, on Glenwood South, $63 million apartments to go vertical. Construction is about to go vertical on a 7-story multifamily building in Raleigh's Glenwood South. Dallas-based Trammell Crow Residential started construction on Alexan Glenwood South in May and has started pouring concrete for the 2-level parking garage. The $63 million project is on track to open in January 2025, according to Managing Director Robert Brooks. The development is situated on nearly an acre at 401 West Lane and 219 North Harrington Streets, just north of the Link Apartments. Alexan Glenwood South will have 186 units with studios, 1- and 2-bedroom units. The company is currently estimating an average rent of about $2,150 per unit, though that could change as the build out is 15 months out, according to Brooks. Amenities include a fitness center, dog spa, and bike maintenance. On Greater Triangle Growth Section is brought to us by Ben Tobin. In Johnston County, a former bank locale is to become a brewery. This is in downtown Selma. A historic building in Selma will soon be the home of a brewery, and a new restaurant could be going in next door. An LLC called B2B Selma, led by Raleigh attorney Jeb Juter and developer Cliff Zinner, purchased 3 buildings in downtown Selma from the Historic Preservation Foundation of North Carolina in November 2021, for a combined price of $160,000, according to Johnston County deed records. The buildings are clustered together at 100 and 104 North Rayford Street and 103 East Anderson Street. Hatchet Brewing Company of Southern Pines will be in the building at 100 North Rayford, which was built in 1922 as a bank before being donated to the town in 1968 for use as a town hall, according to the National Register of Historic Places. Juder says he and Zinner wanted to invest in the next up-and-coming town and fell in love with Selma, which has a population around 7,000, according to U.S. Census Bureau estimates. Johnston County is riding a growth boom that's bringing investments to communities across the county. We're in this for the long haul, Judah says. We're not looking to buy, rehab, and flip. We're deeply invested in Selma and see this as a long-term investment. Judah says he and his partner have poured in well in excess of $1 million to renovate the three buildings. The upper floors of the building feature 7 apartments, Judah says, and he and Zinner are looking at putting a restaurant in the building at 104 North Rayford Street. The building behind the former bank at 103 East Anderson Street will serve as a community event space, Judah says. Founded in 2019 by veterans Greg Walker and Mike Carey, Hatchet Brewing Company is aiming to open the Selma space in March 2024. It's unclear how many employees the brewery will have. Representatives of the company did not respond to requests seeking comment. Other projects reshaping Selma, which sits along Interstate 95, include Adventure Development's Eastfield Crossing, a 3-million-square-foot mixed-use project that will include industrial, commercial, and residential uses. Wawa makes major push into eastern North Carolina. The Pennsylvania-based chain of convenience stores with a fanatical following announced it is planning to open 8 stores in eastern North Carolina in 2024. Over the next decade, Wawa said it plans to have 80 stores across the eastern region of the state. The first 8 stores will be at North Croatan Highway and West 4th Street in Killdevil Hills, Halstead Boulevard and Route 17 in Elizabeth City, Raleigh Road Parkway and Hayes Place in Wilson, Ward Road and Nash Street in Wilson, Benvenue Road and Jeffries Road in Rocky Mount, Wayne Memorial Drive and Hospital Road in Goldsboro, Stantonsburg Road and Moy Boulevard in Greenville, and U.S. Highway 70 and North Carolina Highway 581 in Goldsboro. Opening dates have not been set for the stores. Wawa plans to invest roughly $7 million to build each store, which will have around 35 employees. In Clayton, real estate developer pays $160,000 per acre. A recent land deal in Johnston County came with an eye-popping price per acre as the county continues to attract high-dollar investments. Amelia Townhomes, an LLC tied to real estate firm Tribute Companies in Wilmington, purchased just under 20 acres in Clayton for $3.2 million on October 25th, according to Johnston County deed records. That comes out to more than $160,000 per acre. The wooded and vacant property is off Amelia Church Road, south of Highway 42. It's unclear what Tribute Companies plans to do with the land, although the LLC implies townhomes may be on the way. Representatives of the company did not respond to requests seeking comment. 52 Shades of Success, the Latino influence, explores the challenges and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by those in the Latin American community from all across the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. This 52-week project will also dive into important trends and issues relating to the DEI sector. This week's article is written by Connie Gentry. The Latino 911 call. 8 hours is an agonizingly long time to wonder if your husband is dead or alive. At 1 p.m., the ambulance took her husband from their home, but the woman who called for help didn't speak English. All she understood from the emergency responders was hospital, and nobody at the hospital where he was taken reached out to her. At 9 p.m., after connecting with community health worker Ivan Almont, she could tell her terrified children their father was alive. He spent the next 6 weeks in the hospital and is continuing to recover from COVID-19. During the pandemic, inequities in healthcare became obvious, and when the public health crisis had passed, the Hispanic community continued to bear the brunt of COVID-19's impact. A U.S. Census Bureau survey from June 2022 through December revealed that 36% of the Hispanic population continued to suffer long COVID symptoms, compared with 32% of blacks, 30% of whites, and 21% of Asians. Despite this, the professionals who stepped up to shepherd Latinos and Hispanics through the challenges of the pandemic are moving forward with optimism, convinced that best practices learned have laid the groundwork for better health care outcomes. The pandemic exacerbated a lot of the concerns and barriers we had, says Yasmin Garcia Rico, Director of Latinx and Hispanic Policy and Strategy at the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. But we were able to show things can change and work with many community-based organizations throughout the state to share information and motivate our community to get vaccinated. Those efforts resulted in the Hispanic population getting vaccinated with at least one dose at a higher rate than other ethnic groups. That speaks to the work that can be accomplished when efforts are centered in health equity and we're all working toward the same goal, Rico says. Barriers to health equity that were met head-on during COVID remain top of mind, including struggles with language access, lack of cultural understanding, and negligible representation in healthcare providers. Among U.S. physicians and surgeons, only 7% are Hispanic, and roughly 9% of healthcare practitioners and technicians are Hispanic, according to Pew Research. Representation really matters for people to feel welcome and like there's someone they can connect with, says Rico, adding that some of the biggest gaps in representation are among mental health providers, dentists, and dental hygienists. And across all aspects of healthcare, there are not enough bilingual providers. That's where a certified community healthcare worker can make a dramatic impact, as Ivan Almont did when he responded to a desperate Facebook message from the non-English-speaking woman whose critically ill husband was taken by ambulance. Almont, born and raised in Mexico, has spent over two decades in North Carolina, working as a community organizer for a number of years, and now as a certified community health worker, assisting with mental health services for El Futuro in Durham and with the North Carolina Association of Community Health Workers, providing information for Hispanics on Medicaid expansion. Because of the work I've been doing and the collaborations between community health workers and physicians from hospitals, we were able to identify where her husband was being treated, Almont says. But it was really painful for her family, and for many hours she tried to navigate the system by herself. We have to change the system to be able to provide services in the language of the community. Another thing that needs to change in the system is cultural competency, which Almont alludes to, saying that the women on the emergency call had needed better communication and empathy. She felt the doctors taking care of her husband didn't understand the impact that not knowing what was happening had on his family. The pain and suffering was really big, and it felt lonely because, like many immigrants, they don't have family members here, he says. Sharon Munoz is one of the people working to bring change, and in particular, clear communications and sensitivity to the system. In addition to serving on Governor Cooper's Advisory Council for Hispanic and Latino Affairs, Munoz is the Health Literacy Program Coordinator at Latin 19, a role that positions her to communicate information from government agencies and hospitals in plain and simple language. I relay the message in simple words, what people need to know in 100 words, not 5,000 words, Munoz says. Her work at Latin 19 also put her in line to serve as the Spanish Cohort CHW Coordinator for Bull City Strong, where she teaches health literacy, educating and motivating community health workers to share information with the community. We cover many topics: misinformation about COVID, the impact of family separation, taking care of mental health, diabetes, suicide, pregnancy, medical insurance, she says. Funded by grants through Bull City Strong, participants must live or work in Durham. It could be a mom, a person who is working full-time, a person that is already a community health worker, or somebody who doesn't know anything about health and wants to learn, Munoz says. Taught entirely in Spanish because we understand better in our own language, she adds, the students are paid to attend. When they finish our cohort, we pay for them to go to Durham Tech and continue the education to become a certified community health worker. Almont was a student in the first cohort held in March, and in the cohort that is underway currently, he serves as a presenter. The value for him is, even as someone who was already a CHW, is the opportunity to share experiences, discuss best practices, and develop leadership skills. It's a good way to be in touch with everybody working around healthcare, he says. The requirements of the cohort are to attend every session and to spend 2 hours in the community each week teaching what they learned in class. The March cohort of 21 people reached 8,000 people during the CHW training, 5,000 people within Durham and 3,000 in surrounding counties. That was my main goal, to disseminate information on a greater scale than I could do by myself, Munoz says. Ultimately, she envisions taking the CHW cohorts beyond Durham County, but for now the grant is specific to Durham and has been extended to include two additional cohort classes in 2024. NCDHHS has also been delivering information and addressing healthcare questions for communities throughout the state via online events conducted in Spanish. As of last month, the agency's 18 cafecitos had reached a total of 175,728 participants, with more than 9,700 people actively participating in each event. 15 of the cafecitos included a tele-town hall component, which effectively addressed the digital divide in areas that don't have consistent internet access. People can listen over the phone and ask questions or stream live on Facebook and social media platforms, Rico says. The audience is primarily people with questions about how to find a provider, how to improve health and access to primary care and preventive care. Engagement is higher over the phone connections, which appears to be more comfortable for a lot of people. Being able to connect with mobile devices is important for the farm workers population because many times they are isolated in rural communities where they don't have strong internet, she says. There are definitely more barriers to healthcare in rural communities. In urban settings, more resources are available, with more community organizations and churches providing support, but the Hispanic population is also much denser. In rural counties, the Hispanic population is smaller, but many counties have had a faster growth of this population, so Latinos make up a greater share of the population, Rico says. For example, Duplin County is 24% Hispanic, Sampson County is 22%, and Lee County is 21% Hispanic. The urban areas, Mecklenburg, Wake, Durham, Forsyth, and Guilford, have a huge concentration of Latinos, although Hispanics are only 9 to 14% of the total population. So even if we have more resources, it is not enough to meet the needs of our community. For those who don't have insurance, access to health care is even more difficult, with federally qualified health centers and community clinics filling the void. An assessment by the Census Bureau released at the end of November concluded 18% of Hispanic and Latino people were uninsured, compared with less than 6% of the white non-Hispanic population. Alliance Medical Ministry, AMM, is a nonprofit healthcare clinic in Raleigh, served by more than 2,100 uninsured adults in 2022. Almost two-thirds were Hispanic, and within that population, about half did not speak English. Many of them live in our neighborhood. We're in the middle of the 27610 zip code, which statistically is shown to be one of the areas of greatest need, says Pablo Escobar, who retired October 31st after serving as AMM's Director of Operations since 2019. All of the clinic's patient service representatives are Hispanic, and not only are they linguistically adept, they're also culturally adept, so they know the triggers and communication that will guarantee the message is transmitted. Half of the nursing staff, as well as one of the physicians, a nurse practitioner, and the clinic's community health workers are bilingual. Three-quarters of our patients are below 200% of the poverty level, so that's like $24,000 a year. And if you're supporting a family of four on $24,000, you're not doing good, Escobar adds. Health is crucial to the people we serve because if they don't go to work, they don't get paid. Access to child care and transportation are two of the biggest barriers preventing the Latino community from coming to Alliance, which previously allowed parents to bring children, but that proved too disruptive. Now patients cannot have a child with them in the exam room. However, Alliance has found a good transportation solution in Uber Health, which enables them to arrange a ride for patients either to the clinic or one of their partner providers. Of AMM's $2.5 million operating income, over $1.5 million, which is 62%, comes from fundraising, including $385,000 from corporate and individual donations. In addition to providing a critical safety net for marginalized communities, the benefits extend to the wider community. Hospital utilization is another financial consideration, Escobar says. Tracking patient data and outcomes, he's been able to measure the impact of Alliance's services. We could show the community that people who were uninsured were reducing their unnecessary use of emergency department resources and inpatient resources. This week's editorial is by Editor-in-Chief Sugata Mukherjee. Don't get fooled by the surprising GDP growth. Just a few days ago, the Bureau of Economic Analysis estimated that the U.S. economy grew at a rate of 4.9% during the third quarter. During the second quarter, GDP growth was 2.1%. Numbers from the world's largest economies are not out yet, but I am guessing that other than India and possibly China, which grew by 5% on an annualized rate, but is now faced with an economic crisis, no other economy was hotter. What's driving this growth is that consumer spending, which accounts for more than two-thirds of U.S. economic activity, accelerated 0.7% in September after a 0.4% rise in August. Spending on services shot up 0.8%, boosted by international travel, housing, utilities, healthcare, and airline transportation services. Now fast forward just 1 month later to October, and consumers are staring at 20+% in credit card interest rates for unpaid amounts, 8% mortgage rates, 7% auto finance rates, and minimum $500 monthly student loan payments. For the consumer to spend, it is more than likely they will go into further debt as we draw closer to the holiday shopping season. The most recent numbers released by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York show exactly that. The report finds that household debt has risen to $17 trillion, with about $1 trillion from credit cards. Typically, the mortgage is the most significant debt burden for Americans, which stood at $12 trillion during the second quarter. So consumers are amassing debt, but are they paying their debt on time? Whether it be credit cards, auto loans, mortgages, business loans, etc., the answer is no. VantageScore Credit Gauge, a credit risk tool developed in partnership with the nation's three largest credit reporting agencies, which are Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion, reported October 31st that early-stage delinquencies spiked from 84.1% in August to 91.1% in September across all consumer loan products, the second sharpest monthly increase in a year. What may be more concerning is that after prolonged stability, mortgage delinquency rates are beginning to inch upward again. According to the National Mortgage Professional, the national delinquency rate for September reached 3.29%, marking a 12 basis points rise from August and a 13 basis points year-over-year increase. This shift represents the most significant and only the second annual uptick in the past 2.5 years. As for auto loans, in September, the percentage of auto borrowers who were at least 60 days late on their bills rose to 6.11%, according to a Fitch Ratings report. That marks the highest default level since 1994. A big part of the reason for these defaults is the monthly car payments, which have risen sharply ever since interest rates started climbing. A Financial Times report concludes one out of every five car owners with a loan has a $1,000 monthly car payment. So what will the fourth quarter look like when numbers come out in late January? And if we are thinking that the economy will grow by 4 or 5%, I would also like to know the growth in the debt levels of the American consumer. When the labor market is strong and with the larger cross-section of workers under the impression that finding a good job is really not hard, spending is likely to continue, whether people can afford it or not. But overzealous consumerism, especially as we approach a period when retail spending is at its highest level, can spell disaster for businesses in 2024. It was encouraging to see the third quarter GDP growth, but we may have reached the peak for the next few quarters. Turning to the big numbers, $200 million. That's how much Acquity Solutions, a clinical documentation firm based in Cary, sold for recently in a deal with IKS Health of Dallas. Acquity has 7,000 employees across the globe. $752 million. That was First Citizens' net income for the recent quarter, as CEO Frank Holding Jr. says the long-term outlook remains positive after its purchase of Silicon Valley Bank, whose assets were taken over by regulators in March. $10 million. That's how much Scion NeuroStim has recently raised in equity from 13 investors, according to an October 13th securities filing. $1.2 million. That's how much Cookout paid for 2 acres of property at 1200 North Arundel Avenue in Zebulon back in 2020. Now Cookout plans a restaurant would be larger than typical locations at 4,625 feet with indoor seating. 342. That's the number of homes Turnkey Contractors of Rocky Mount plans to build on the former Birchwood Country Club golf course in Nashville. 600 plus. The number of active listings for homes priced at $1 million or above in the Triangle, according to Triangle MLS data provided by Bo Bromhall with Berkshire Hathaway Services. In the quotables this week, most enterprises are very quick to realize if you are more productive, that means you have a competitive advantage to your peers. That's IBM CEO Arvind Krishna on an earnings call saying when it comes to AI applications in coding, customers are looking to get rid of any developers. In more quotable, the master plan is grounded in reality. It will be market-driven, and it will understand the reality of the market and interest rates and the appetite in Raleigh. That's Kevin Sullivan, Vice President for Real Estate and Strategic Development on Shaw University's hiring a firm to help with the master plan after the rezoning for 26 acres of its campus was approved. Like many restaurant owners, I've seen great success, but also measure that success against time with family and pursuing other passions, which is part of the reason why I've decided to close my franchises. That's Triangle entrepreneur Ephraim Yates on closing his remaining restaurants. The Your Pie Pizza locations in Raleigh and Durham are now closed for good. And that is about all we have time for this week. We've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Hugh Bennett, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.